From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Chris Sapone. It's Wednesday, May 20th. For the duration of the COVID-19 crisis, Please Explain is coming to you 5 days a week. Since yesterday, nationwide, 9 new cases of coronavirus have been confirmed as we continue to flatten the curve. I'm joined now by National Science reporter Liam Mannix. Welcome back to Please Explain, Liam.
G'day, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Now, the question that everybody wants to know is, how long until we get a vaccine for coronavirus?
Yeah, you guys keep asking me this, and I don't have an update for you because the answer is still the same. The world's top scientists say it's 12 to 18 months. Now, that was from the start of the crisis. We're, 4 months into it now. So maybe it's 8 to 12 months. But really, these figures are so rubbery, Chris. The fastest we have ever built a vaccine is 5 years. We're trying to do this so quickly and with so much urgency, and nobody knows if we can. There's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of hope, there are some things that are promising that I think we're going to discuss, but there is also the real chance, and we have to confront this, that we may never get a vaccine. So I think that the answer is people are working really hard, but we've never done this before and we don't know how long it's going to take.
And so what is so difficult about making a vaccine for a coronavirus versus other types of infections?
I suppose the problem is not specific to coronaviruses here so much. The particular virus that we're interested in here, called SARS-CoV-2, actually looks like a pretty good target for a vaccine. Scientists who've had a look at it say, yeah, we think we can beat this. And the crucial reason for that is because it doesn't appear to mutate very quickly. Unlike the flu, which mutates so often that essentially you get a flu vaccine and then it's of no use next year, we think, looking at the coronavirus, that if you give people a vaccine that works for it, it should offer pretty good protection. So really, Chris, the challenge is not so much in the coronavirus itself, but in building a vaccine this quickly. You can make vaccines in a lab. And in fact, I think there's more than 100 teams now that have got vaccines that work quite nicely on human dishes in a cell. But it is enormously more difficult to go from that to a vaccine that actually works in a human. And that kind of explains why, despite there being lots and lots of viruses that menace humanity, we haven't actually got that many vaccines.
And can you say, in the case of this effort to try to find a vaccine, how well positioned are international corporations and nations to take up this work?
I think it's really the nature of the business and of the science. Like, obviously, we could have done more. I've reported on some SARS vaccines that almost got to human trials before they got defunded by the US government. Now, we could have potentially used those SARS vaccines for SARS-CoV-2. We've reported extensively on the real economic problems of building a vaccine, because most vaccines, you give them once, you're often giving them to some of the poorest people in the world. So there's not a lot of money in doing these. So it's really hard to get pharma interested, and it costs so much to make. But Chris, the real challenge of making these vaccines is they're really, really difficult. So you want to make a vaccine that is safe and that protects people. And one thing that I was sort of talking with scientists about this week is the difficulty of doing a clinical trial for a vaccine. Because what you want to do is give a vaccine to a group of people and then prove that it stops them getting the virus. Now, if you imagine in a country like Australia, hardly anybody here is getting the virus. So how can you statistically show that your vaccine is protecting those people? You'd need to vaccinate literally the whole country with your test vaccine, and then make sure that your testing was capturing 100% of infections, and then monitor them for long enough to prove that the vaccine works. Now, it'll be easier in other countries to do because their infection rates are higher, but the clinical trials for these things are so difficult to get them to be statistically significant. And I don't think people quite appreciate that, how hard that is. The reality is, Chris, at the moment, scientific ethics, and I think quite reasonably, make it really hard to give someone a vaccine and then directly expose them to coronavirus. I mean, you might end up killing them. How can you test a vaccine like that?
There have been reports recently of people who are stepping up saying, yes, I would be a human guinea pig. Is that right? I mean, does that mark a change in sort of some of the public's behavior around this, because they want to see some resolution to this pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of brave people out there, but a lot of the testing that is being done at the moment is safety testing. So, you know, give someone a vaccine and check that it doesn't have some sort of terrible result. That's very brave. I think it's probably a step up in bravery, Chris, to give someone a vaccine and then expose them to a deadly virus. And you can't just do young, healthy people, can you? Because you have to make sure that it works for the elderly, who are the people who really need it. So you have to take someone who, let's say, on published statistics, has perhaps a 20% chance of being killed by this virus, give them a vaccine and then expose them to it. Like, I don't know. I'm not sure I'd take those odds.
It's a big ask. So looking at Australia in particular, when, you know, as a vaccine it goes through development, what will Australia's role be? Is it likely that it would be that the vaccine would be originated here, or would labs in Australia, research labs in Australia, be working and collaborating with labs overseas that are further along in various stages of this progress? Or is there any sense of how that might play out?
Yeah, it could be both. It's really exciting, actually. Australia's playing a really key role. So up at the University of Queensland, we've got a team up there led by Professor Young, and they're doing amazing work. They were funded by a coalition of countries who were interested in pandemic vaccines to start developing a vaccine that could be used for any pandemic virus. And then it just so happened that as they were starting work on that, COVID-19 came along. So they've got some funding. They're progressing through animal trials. You'd have to say that they are one of the front runners, because they are funded by this big team whose sole funding responsibility is to try and pick the vaccines that might stop a pandemic. So, you know, it's a pretty good sign if they're getting money from them. But Australia is also playing a key role in testing these technologies. So we're one of the only countries in the world, and I don't think this gets enough attention, that has what's called a biosecurity 4 level facility. And that's the CSIRO's animal health lab down in Geelong. And this is really, in some ways, the jewel in Australia, in the crown of Australia's science, this overlooked facility, because it allows you to do animal testing of super deadly viruses like COVID-19. And there aren't many places that can really do this at the level that we can. So at the moment down there, they've got, they're using ferrets for this, and they've given ferrets a couple of vaccines from teams overseas, I think one from the UK and one from America, and they're now exposing them to the virus to see if it can actually stop them becoming infected. So we could make a breakthrough there. We could be the site of a key breakthrough that shows that a vaccine might work in humans. There's going to be a whole nother layer of economics and politics that's eventually going to settle on top of this science. And that's going to be, where do we make the vaccine? How much does it cost? And who gets it first? And those are some of the questions that I think, you know, our political reporting staff are really going to need to be cluey to, because that seems to me to be, you know, a really important question.
And that's sort of this notion of vaccine nationalism that government bodies are already warning against. Is that right? Where some countries, if they've got it, that if they have the breakthrough, then presumably they would enjoy the spoils of that breakthrough. But that kind of goes against the spirit of what, international cooperation.
Well, yeah, we reported that Donald Trump had already tried to purchase a German company manufacturing a vaccine, with the express intent that the vaccine would get to America first. And several pharma companies have already said, yes, we will give it to the country that we are based in first, and then we'll give it to the rest of the world. I mean, you can see that playing out in so many ways. Like, how do we equitably give this to people? Who gets it first? I mean, imagine if a country that wanted to exert some geopolitical influence, like, say, China, got it first, and then said to the US, well, you can have it, but here are our conditions.
Earlier, you mentioned the possibility that maybe a vaccine wouldn't be found. And if that's the case, then what kind of world are we looking at in the next, say, 2 to 5 years? I mean, do we stop doing things that we're used to doing, you know, to being able to do? Do we stop going to sporting events, concerts, for fear of infection? What does that look like?
Yeah, look, it's something you can't rule out. I mean, the scientists are sort of looking at this virus, as we said before, and saying, yeah, we think we should be able to get a vaccine for this. But the vagaries of the human body are infinite, and we do not understand them all. Most studies that are done in animals where it works, it looks like it should work in humans, simply don't work in humans. And it's often for reasons that we don't really understand. So, look, it looks like we should get a vaccine, but we can't rule out not getting one. Now, what does a world look like where coronavirus continues to circulate? I think part of that is going to come down to how effective treatments we can find for it. You know, if you could largely stop people dying, then you can have one response to it. If we can't find a way of stopping people who catch it from dying, then I'm not sure what you can really do other than reducing the spread of the virus as low as you can, which is all of the sort of social distancing measures that we've done so far. But, you know, it's a scary future, and I'd hesitate to guess what it's going to look like. I'm just hoping they get a vaccine, Chris.
In this kind of scenario, though, where there's not a vaccine worked out, then does detection become even more important? I know you've written a story about a plan to try to work out a new process for detecting when these viruses crossed over from animals into the human population. Could you talk a little bit about that and how effective that sort of project was?
Yeah, well, this makes a lot of sense, this approach, I think, Chris. We know that pandemics are increasingly a threat to human life. And you can see this in the scientific papers. The predictions have been there for a long time, saying that because of what humans are doing, the growing scale of our population, increasing international transit links that allow the virus to spread easily around the globe, and the fact that we're pushing more and more into up against animals is going to increase our virus risk. And that's because animals have so many viruses compared to humans. And some of those viruses can jump. So if we push humans to be too close, like with things like wet markets, then you increase over time the risk of a virus jumping from an animal to a human and causing a pandemic. So it's there in the scientific papers, and it's also been borne out in real life. In the last 20 years alone, we've had SARS, we've had MERS, we've now got COVID-19. I think Ebola was linked to bats. We've got various influenzas linked to different animals like bird flu and swine flu. So you can see the evidence with your own eyes. This is an increasing threat. So the question then becomes, right, what are we going to do? Because it's hard to stop people spreading out all around the world. So the US government had this idea that what they could do was spend a large amount of money to send scientists to every corner of the world to gather all of the viruses that were in animals. And you could sample them all and perhaps put them in a computer. And the computer might be able to look at their genetics and say, oh, we think this is most likely to jump, or we think that's most likely to jump. And then you can go and, you know, set up some defenses there. Unfortunately, what Australian researchers showed, and I think this is borne out, is that the program probably was never going to work because there are so many viruses, Chris. There are about 260 viruses that affect humans. There are about 1.6 million viruses that affect mammals and waterfowl. And there's about 87 million viruses that affect all complex life on Earth. And that's a rough guess. And many of these viruses can jump to humans, and we're not sure which. And we don't know why they can jump. We don't know why some are more likely to jump than others. The researchers looked at that and said the scale of this task is just Herculean. We can't do this. We can't sample enough of these viruses to work out which is going to jump. Their solution, expensive, difficult, but perhaps something that the world should consider in the future, was to set up blood surveillance in human populations around the world. So you might set up a blood clinic at the Wuhan wet market, testing people regularly to see if they've got any sort of novel viruses that might have jumped over. And then you might be able to pick up COVID-19 in somebody's blood, remembering that COVID-19 doesn't make everybody sick who gets it. You could probably pick it up early and say, oh, hang on, there's a virus here. And it buys you a few extra weeks to react. And as we know, Chris, those few weeks are absolutely critical in controlling the spread of a pandemic.
Liam, I thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Today's episode of Please Explain was produced by David Escort and Amelia McGuire. The journalists, editors, photographers, producers, and tech team at The Age and the City Morning Herald are working tirelessly to cover the COVID-19 crisis factually, fairly, and comprehensively. For coverage you can trust, visit our websites or buy our papers. To support our journalism, you can subscribe via our homepages or just search subscribe, The City Morning Herald, or The Age. I'm Chris Sapone. Thanks for listening.